Thank you. Right, thanks very much. Let's resume. So we're still in question F, and then we have two more questions to go after that, so I'm hopeful of an early finish this afternoon, particularly as I'm going to first of all take question H before question G, because I think it ties in better to what we're discussing currently. And then when we get to G, given we had a lot of discussion about inflation yesterday, I'm unless there are new things to be said, which I suspect might be difficult, but it's always possible, I'm hoping that discussion will be relatively short. But let's carry on with F, since that's where we are currently. And when we finished, there were a number of boards up, some of which may well have come down since then, people wanted to come in with further points. So can we work down the table from this end? Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you. I was quite bemused by the comments from Mr. Ashworth before the break. We've heard repeatedly that the plan's delivery blind. I would respectfully say, we now appear to be hearing that the plan is delivery model inclusive, i.e. we can cherry pick the best aspects of each delivery model as we go along. I'll give a real-world example of this with direct reference to Mr. Ashworth's assertion around the ability for an LLNTDC to rescue things a few years into the process. So just to understand the scenario, we begin with private sector developers, I believe, and then at some point in time, we're not achieving the policy requirements that we expect. So we then ask the Secretary of State to form an LLNTDC to define the new town at that point in time. And then we CPO the land efficiently, and capturing land value by CPOing in order to save the garden community principles or policies. I mean, this is simply not practicable. And I'll expand on this. At the point in time at which we attempt to save the garden community policies by forming this LLNTDC, we'll still have the problem which has cropped up again and again and again around paragraphs 143, 144 of the government guidance around willing developers having actually delivered quite a large portion of a scheme and being willing to continue to do so.
Wait a minute. Mr. Ashworth said that this intervention wouldn't happen after the scheme had begun. Because I asked him that. That's what I thought he meant initially. What he said was that the point at which a decision whether or not it was necessary to set up a development corporation in this scenario would be taken at the point when a planning application came forward, and the relevant authorities looked at it, and at that point they would. I mean, it may not be a single point in time, obviously, but that would be a judgment made on the proposals in front of them in a planning application that would guide the authority's decision as to whether it was okay to let the planning application go ahead because it met all the requirements of policy and so on, or whether they needed to say no, that's not doing what the policy requires. Presumably we'll refuse that application because of that. My assumption, not what they said. And that's when they would make the decision to pursue the development corporation route.
This was not what I heard from Mr. Ashworth initially, I must admit.
Have I summarised correctly what you...
Yes.
Even if you didn't say it the first time, what I'm pretty sure you said it the second time. In any case, that's what you intended to say. And I think you did say it, to be fair to you.
I think I said it the first time. I did say it the second time.
I may have misunderstood
it for the third time. Yes.
Yeah, I asked you to say it again because I wasn't quite sure what I'd heard the first time, which I'm, but yes. Okay,
well, briefly working under that assumption. So I apologise if the misunderstanding was mine. Briefly working under that assumption. So the question we were answering, or I think the point we were addressing is, how do we ensure that policy protection prevails? So I think what we're saying is there is potentially a non-delivery blind mechanism to achieve this during a short period of time at the start of the project. So it appears we now have acceptance of the point which I was going to make, I believe, which is once the sites have actually begun development, that is very hard to retrospectively form an LLNTDC, define a town, and CPO land such that one can achieve land value capture.
Perhaps I could put that point back across to the authority a minute. That's why I asked the question in the first place, because it seemed to me that would be very difficult, if not impossible. And that's why I was pleased when Mr. Ashworth clarified that that wasn't what they meant. But anyway, you can speak for yourselves.
I agree with you, sir. And part of the logic to that is that we would have gone through, by that stage, a long process of defining a DPD, of working with the promoters on an application, on negotiating conditions, negotiating a planning agreement that would... we would say would deliver a garden community in accordance with policy. Having gone through that process, we would have a degree of confidence at least that is what would end up being delivered, and there would be enforcement mechanisms within the planning controls that would allow the NEA to be sure that was the case.
May I continue briefly? I'm not sure it really is addressing what the original question was about policy protection, because these are 50-year to 80-year sites. So we're really saying there's a short period at the start before anything's actually happened, apart from potentially, I guess, some changes in economics that lead us to question viability. But once we're up and running and, for example, delivery rates drop or someone struggles to refinance their loan at an acceptable rate, or I could paint any one of about 15 different problematic scenarios, I guess we're now accepting there's no real protection mechanism there. And I guess this emphasises the point of... definitely the point of not having marginal viability up front, for sure, because we have a small window where there may be some state intervention, LLNTDC intervention to help us protect policy. But beyond that, after that, we have exactly the risks that we've looked at with all of the viability assumptions.
Mr. Sunnox.
Yes, the structure is shifting before our eyes and new things are coming up even today that we haven't seen before. It would shorten this afternoon quite a lot if we were to feel we had another final opportunity to comment on this after we finished today, when we've had time to digest what we've been told today. So that's just a small sort of administrative point that will foreshorten this afternoon, which I'm sure would be popular. The point This session is about viability and how you do your appraisals and how you reach conclusions on viability. And I want to take, not confuse this point at all with whether it's possible to have a legally binding structure that gives you control of the land so that you pay for it later. If you have such a structure, assume for a minute that such a structure exists. How do you go about doing your appraisals and what do you compare? Do you compare the future value of the land that's been agreed to be paid, or do you take it back to the present value? And I think that the one thing that all the financial people around the table on both sides of the table have agreed on is that there is a time value for money, and that an early settlement of land value is at a lower price than a later one. I think everyone agrees on that. And so we would suggest it's that early value that should be compared to current land prices, not the later one. And that makes a massive difference to viability. It really is, transformational.
Thank you. Mrs. Luxford-Vaughan.
I will confess before I say anything that I'm particularly confused. One, because I've been told from the start that we were definitely going to be using NEGC as the main contractor, and we've heard today that actually that may not happen. My question is if we don't set up LNNTC, then how can the tendering site even go ahead? Because at the moment there isn't a developer with the capacity to be able to purchase. They don't have the funding. Obviously, the LNQ have got big, deep pockets, and they could do it independently, but that's not the case. So we're forced into a situation, surely, where we have to set that up in the first place.
Ms. Gregory, is it? Or Yeah.
thank you very much, sir. I think it'd just be quite useful to take a step back for a moment. I remember that the question that you asked, which predicated all of this, was if the necessary land is not purchased up front, of which we're the only party that have said we will do, what contractual or legal mechanisms are needed to ensure that it can be drawn down as and when is required? And I think, putting aside the later debate, you had representations from quite a lot of the promoters and developers across the table telling you that there are contractual legal obligations in place. This is a tried and tested method. It's not something that is completely and utterly new, crazy. This is how development of a large scale is delivered. Putting that aside, I think what we need to consider is that effectively there's three different strands at looking at this. There's the NEA's approach, which is a delivery blind approach in terms of the viability models that they've submitted. There's the NEGC's approach, which is the creation of a development corporation or whatever buzzword we're using at the time. And then you've got the private sector that are also putting forward viabilities that are proving that the schemes are viable. Those are three separate ways of looking at the viability of these schemes, all of which are saying that the schemes are viable. My final point is that the buzzword of land value capture has been dropped in. At no point has this really been discussed. I would strongly suggest it's not picked up today, because that's a whole separate debate about how development contributions will be funded, if it's appropriate for land value capture to be looked at in this way. I understand that there is guidance that will be coming out in the next few months discussing that. But I think if we're going to go down that route, that would have to be a whole separate session.
Thank you. Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, sir. And I appreciate that some of this is a very pure planning context, that this debate is happening around levers and mechanisms. But just for the avoidance of doubt, and you've heard, I think, a few times now me say that we have been working now quite hard in the last year or so on a locally led development corporation and talking to the landowners and developers about doing this through private treaty. You also know through the viability assessment that we're talking about bringing the land in at an early stage, and we are, in viability terms, able to schedule infrastructure and the whole site economics. I think, just for the avoidance of doubt again, my board gave me an instruction back in October to pursue the preparation of an outline business case, a Treasury-compliant outline business case for a local-led development corporation, potentially for them, subject to the outcome of this inquiry, to be able to then consider it, their councils, during the course of this summer, depending on the timing. And therefore, the timing is really important from a more strategic and commercial perspective, because the board, shareholders of which are the four councils, are intending to progress this now. And I thought I made that point clear before lunch. We are doing it in a positive way, and we're intending to progress this now ahead of 2-3 years time, when you get to the pure planning mechanic that you're exploring in this question around DPD stroke planning application. So we would not, and neither would my shareholders, want us to wait until that point from a strategic and a commercial perspective. I appreciate that this is about planning, but you need to know that context. It's a matter of public record.
Any A's want to say at this point? I will take further comments, but are there any responses you want to make at this point?
Yes, sir. If I could just pick on the issue, back to the question F and the mechanisms, as it's been debated, there's been lots on that actual mechanism. I think what Mr. Sonnex is leading to is more around the price of the land and how that may change and the discounting type approach. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you got enough from the explanation of the agreements that are in place, but I'm sure all of those agreements have minimum prices with indexation of some form related to that. The promoters could probably explain a bit more on that if need be. And it probably takes us to the question on inflation as to how we deal with inflation in the round. So if there's an indexation of a certain value, it brings into question the broader position on how you're dealing with inflation on costs and values, all costs, including the land cost. Mm. So it may be something that we come back to when we come on to that question.
Yeah. Yes, that is a good point. What I got from Mr. Cock on that was that the land would be revalued every 3 years, so not index, but actually a fresh evaluation of the land every 3 years. Is that's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Mr. Vessenhoff, I don't think. Ah, yes. What he said was, in the early stages, before the scheme goes cash positive, there would be a fixed amount paid per acre to the landowner. I'm looking for confirmation here.
Yes, that's correct.
And then once the cash flow is positive, land would be paid for at market value.
Correct again.
Yeah. So at market value, does that mean a similar mechanism to Mr. Cock, in the sense that every time you bought a piece of land, or the developers bought a piece of land, there would be a separate evaluation of that piece of land?
Essentially there's flexibility built in to the agreement in terms of the quantum of drawdown and the timing, and that there is a safeguard in place, as you'd expect for a landowner, in terms of a minimum
price.
But the actual price beyond that is agreed at the time, based on what is to be delivered within the parcel that is to be drawn down.
Mr. Sproul, I think you said the pricing mechanism would be assessed at the time of drawdown.
Yes, similar to the L&Q model, there would be that flexibility. There would be a set of parameters to begin with, and then there would be the flexibility to value at the appropriate rate.
Appropriate rate, do you mean indexing?
The appropriate appraisal that will be taking place at that point.
Appraisal,
in time.
Yeah. Mr. Bradley, I don't think you specifically said how land would actually be priced, what the mechanism would be for pricing land.
I don't have authorization to release the confidential information, yes, I'm afraid. Yes, I can ask my clients and see if we can get that to you, but yeah. I doubt it.
Yeah, no, that's right. Remember, that is
it does work in the principles if we've done it in the viability there.
Thank you. Right, I'll go back down the table one more time then. Mr. O'Connell.
I think that was a valuable confirmation to make. And I'll briefly just address the point from Hyas, because I obviously made the point earlier that if one is going to wait a certain period of time to receive one's money, then one needs some sort of interest or compensation. To be clear, this is not related to inflation, and I guess I would observe it as a further confusion around inflation. Mm-hmm. This is not related to inflation. Mm-hmm. If, let's say, you're looking at this in a world without inflation, i.e. Mm-hmm. the actual model which Hyas is doing, for example. Mm-hmm. You're not receiving interest or compensation because of inflation. I would expect there to be inflation in an inflation world, as we live in those agreements. But separately, there would need to be some sort of interest compensation or indeed revaluation clauses, as we've just heard, to reflect the fact that you've waited for the land, that you know you're in a different position. In the future, you've waited for your money. It's less valuable than if you received it at the start. So it's nothing to do with inflation. It's to do with time value of money, which is just as applicable in a real, without inflation world and a nominal world. My second point is that actually these discussions of the mechanisms shows how far away we are in the modelling from the real world in a way that significantly favours viability. In the modelling, as we know, we look at a residual land value, we say this is the value we can pay for the land, but we're going to pay it over time with no additional compensation, interest, adjustment for people. What we've just heard is that, of course, there are adjustments required. From a time value of money perspective, these adjustments will be upwards adjustments. So in the modelling, this is not reflected at all, the fact that we are deferring payment for land and that will need to be at higher values than the value we would pay if it's not up front. So actually, what we've articulated, particularly Mr. Sunnox, around this time value of money, net present value point, is entirely compatible with the real-world examples that we've heard. What is not compatible is the way it's currently modelled and looking at a static benchmark land value. This is a significant hole in the viability, which is not reflected. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm concerned we've just heard from the promoter of the biggest garden community in the country that land value capture is not a feature. Firstly, we as residents of North Essex have been hearing for several years that land value capture is a feature, and we've been told anecdotally that compulsory purchase is the way that will be achieved. Secondly, it's the first principle on the TCPA Charter, Garden City Principles.
I can't comment on the TCPA Charter principles of exactly what they say and exactly what they mean by land value capture. I think, I mean, Ms. Gregory will speak for herself in a moment, but I assume when she was saying it's not part of the, it's not something we're looking at here, you meant in the sort of strict sense of land value capture in the strict policy sense or this emerging sense in which it's being used. But, well, I mean, others will speak, but my understanding is that principles of land value capture as articulated, you know, by the NEAs and so on, are not to do with a precise particular mechanism of how land value is captured, but with sharing the value of land uplift to ensure that, sharing land value uplift in such a way as to ensure that the various infrastructure requirements and all the other things that go into making the garden community principles work are actually delivered. And as you know, that doesn't necessarily require one way of doing that, provided that that it's done effectively. That would be my understanding of it. I confess I'm not expert in the way that land value capture is being used in a specific sense, which is what I think Ms. Greger was alluding to, but perhaps you could clarify that.
Yeah, very quickly on that. I think this is where we've got to be... The point I was trying to make was we've got to be careful about the terminology of land value capture, because land value capture can mean many things. One of the things that we've been very clear about from the very start is that we've got a fully costed up plan to provide a sustainable community in terms of the social infrastructure that we're providing as well. We've never said that we're not providing that, and we have a whole IDP that sets out exactly what we're providing. In terms of land value capture, I'm referring to it in terms of the wider sense that's currently being looked at from a governmental point of view, which looks at things like SIL, roof tax, strategic infrastructure levy, which is a whole different debate that I don't think is appropriate to go down here, because as far as I'm concerned, it's not been discussed.
Well, I think broadly that's right, yes, yes. Mr. Sunnox.
Yes, I want to take the strongest issue on this land value capture thing. We're not trying to look at government policy at all. What we're trying to look at is whether, as we sit here today, trying to show whether the plan's deliverable or not, whether the authorities have at their disposal tools to capture the land value and to look at the balance of power between them and the promoters. And what we're being lured into now is to basically allocate some land and then negotiate the land value capture, the split of the land, if it's associated with policy, the split of the land value uplift between infrastructure and land. And this is just, to me as a commercial person, this is just an awful thing to go and do. You spent a lot of money on getting so far, and not one acre of land is owned by the authorities. And now you go and allocate it, and then you go and try and negotiate the split after you've committed to it. What a weak position you're going to be in. You're going to have to, you won't be able to deliver your land unless you reach your housing targets unless you reach an agreement. So you're under huge pressure. And we are sitting here saying that the public interest needs to be protected on this with much stronger hardwiring and things that I think are even possible in the plan. In fact, we're going to be arguing on Matter 9, we're going to be arguing that the only way of properly hardwiring this is to actually remove the garden communities from the plan. We're walking into an awful situation. Now, we've also heard quite a lot about the relationships of the options at landowner level. And again, that doesn't go to the relationship between the public sector and the split of land value uplift. It's a relationship between the developer and the landowner. Okay, so the developers may be able to control the land, okay, but are they going to be able to control it at a price that enables them to deliver the uplifts that have been promised? And we have before us four different developers saying they've got some control of the land. Galliard won't say anything about what their deal is. And the other three, all of them, have got revaluation mechanisms in. So all is there to play for. The actual important bit, which is the price, hasn't been done, hasn't been agreed. So even at that level, we don't see that there's enough control of the land. And certainly at local authority level, they are just about to make an awful mistake in allocating this land before they've agreed the uplifts.
Thank you. Ms. Warren, is it?
Thank you, sir.
I wasn't going to raise this point, but given that Mr. Snakes has raised it, I'll just pick up that point, if I may, and then go to the point I was going to originally make. So far as we're concerned, there's sufficient control over our land, and indeed it appears from others around the table, via options and other mechanisms. Options are a very well-trodden route to delivery, and certainly are in part of the industry. Many house builders around here well experienced using that mechanism and have delivered very large schemes on that basis. So I'm not entirely sure I can agree with what Mr. Sunnox has said. What I wanted to originally make my observations on, sir, was, as we've mentioned before, the local plan delivery bind approach is the best one that can be given at this stage, and I think it's the right one, sir. Whilst any GC outline their case, this outline case which it heard is going to go forward to their board in the summer, it is just an aspiration. It is for the local authority to decide if they think, as their board, there is sufficient justification for that. And more importantly, sir, the Secretary of State has to endorse that. And in the regulations on New Towns Act Regulations 2018, there's a section on the best route for delivery, and it says, in particular, the Secretary of State will want to be satisfied that this level of public sector intervention, and by which they're talking about new town designation, sir, is needed, and to satisfy himself that a similar outcome would be unlikely using other private or public sector delivery models. So this is not, oh yeah, that's fine, sir. This is, you have to show that other mechanisms or models couldn't deliver the similar outcome. And so far as sitting here, sir, I mean, you've got a number of private sector involved parties who've done this before in terms of these options and high quality development. So I think it would be very difficult to justify a need for a development corporation. And so consequently the NEA's approach is the most sensible and correct approach.
Mr. Cock.
To me the most important thing is the policy. We're talking about delivery blind, and so we've got three options potentially of at the moment as how they deliver, but all of those delivery mechanisms will have to concur with the policy. So the checks and balances that are required, quite rightly by cause, are all going to be set out in the policy. So as long as the policy is correct, I would say the checks and balances are there for whatever mechanism we're delivering with.
Ms. Gregory?
I'll try and keep it brief. I think there's three points I'd like to finish on this particular topic, which is, it's firstly not very appropriate for us really to go into too much detail about the contractual arrangements. With the greatest respect, this is a planning inquiry, well, local plan examination. I think it would open up a can of worms if we were to start going into the various contractual obligations about with dealing with different parties. The second point, and again, with my surveyor's hat on, apologies, we have to be very careful that we are considering this in viability terms, not valuation terms. There is a distinction between the two, and we have to be very careful about what it is that we're saying. And the third point is that, again, going back to this sort of land value capture, I think it's probably better that we call it planning obligations, because ultimately that's how it will be secured, in my view. Whether it's through Section 106, Section 278, or various other agreements. And I think within all of the models, there is an element of that. They might not be necessarily costed out of the various cost plans, but, for example, we've got, I think, £350 million of what I would consider to be planning obligation cost within our model already. Thank you.
It was just a quick point about the time value of money and that there are mechanisms in landowner agreements to potentially increase values over time. the reference you got was market value. So market value has regard to what you can do with that land and the obligations that be upon it. It's not a fixed position which has disregard to that. And what we're talking about is a minimum land value. Can a minimum land value in the contracts be achieved? And our answer is yes, they can. So it doesn't matter whether we have an ability to inflate the values. If that's not available, can we achieve the minimum? Yes. And if there's money that can be shared on land value at a later stage, then fine, because you've achieved all the other things you need to achieve.
So let's say, for the sake of argument, that the minimum land value in the option is 100,000 an acre. So you're saying that there would be and you've got an agreement with you've got an option agreement with revaluation clauses in it. But are you saying that in 30 years' time, if you offered somebody the minimum price of £100,000 an acre, they'd be obliged to take it, notwithstanding the revaluation clauses?
Well, if the revaluation clauses didn't go above the 100,000, that would be the minimum.
If they didn't go
above? Yeah, if they go above, then it's based on market value, which will have regard to everything else you've got in the plan and all the rest of it. So that's already accounted for in your assessment.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't result in an inflation and you had a contract that lasted 30 years, then you would be obligated to sell it on that basis, yes.
Mr. Bailey.
I'll be brief, sir. Just a point about Mrs. Warren picking up the test that she quoted. We're very alive to that test, and you've heard already today three aspects of that that we've been working on and we've evidenced over the last few days to you. First is the whole site test. The second is the exploration of doing this in partnership with private sector through private treaty agreements, which is, again, re-emphasise our primary approach. And at this stage, if you were then to sort of translate that back into option agreements, they would be part and parcel of all of that discussion. But at the, where you were at with the point in the planning inquiry is that they would then be part of the next stage following the allocation. Part and parcel of that negotiation and that discussion at the next stage.
Mr. Byrne.
So I was just going to come back on the, since while we're here, the local plan will set a policy context. That itself will, as we've heard, impact on values of land. I think you expressed it well when you said what we are looking at is achieving the garden community objectives, and then to do so, it is recognised that the uplift in land value is such that you would need to secure the appropriate level of that to secure those garden community objectives. That policy context will be set both by this plan, if you find it sound. It will then be set also by the DPDs. It might be set by a range of other guidance, because that will be part of the policy considerations. It'll certainly be set by any planning permission or LDO, if that's the mechanism that is used. And it's that combination of factors which ultimately, from a planning authority perspective, we are using as a means of achieving the end result. That clearly, as you have heard already, impacts on the land value and will impact on any reassessment of that land value going forward in any re-evaluation.
I'm going to move on to question H, which will, I think, enable us to continue and develop the discussion we've been having already. So my original question 10 was asking whether the highest appraisals should have applied a benchmark land value to each of the garden communities, and if so, what that value should be. The response from the NEAs was as follows, that they say that benchmark land values are often unevidenced, and if not adjusted to reflect policy requirements, can lead to a situation in which policy requirements are found to make development unviable. Consequently, the viability assessment update approach does not attempt to define a theoretical benchmark beyond the recognition that residential land values need to be sufficiently above the current agricultural use values to incentivize owners to bring land to the market. It is a matter of judgment as to whether the garden community proposals achieve this. And then many other participants argue that there should be a benchmark land value, and the majority suggest around 100,000 an acre minimum is appropriate. The PPGs, which Mr. Brierley alluded to yesterday, planning practice guidance on land value, relating to the question of benchmark, the 2014 guidance quotes the National Planning Policy Framework as saying that viability should consider competitive returns to a willing landowner and willing developer to enable the development to be deliverable. And it goes on to say that a competitive return for the landowner is the price at which a reasonable landowner would be willing to sell their land for development. The price will need to provide an incentive for the landowner to sell in comparison with the other options available. There is reference in the 2019 PPG to benchmark land value, but it's something of a moot point as to whether 2019 PPG applies in this examination. So that's the context. So I'm the person, it looks to me from what the NEAs have said, is that I'm the person who's got to use my judgment as to whether the garden community proposals achieve a level of residual land value that is sufficiently above current agricultural use values to incentivize owners to bring land to the market. So my question is precisely that. How far above do they need to be sufficiently far above to incentivize owners to bring land to the market? I'd like to ask someone from the NEAs if they'd like to tackle that question, please.
Yes, sir. As you appreciate, there's quite a lot of commentary in our hearing statement on this very issue in terms of where we see the position that's been taken by various parties and where that comes from and whether it is relevant or evidenced in terms of some of the views that...
Your position I'm looking for.
Sure. Well, the material sets out, as you've kind of quoted back to us there, that we consider that this is it is difficult to set a benchmark in this case. It is always needs to relate to the circumstances of the project that you're assessing. And there are not only contextual in terms of the infrastructure requirements and the nature of the scheme that's at play there and the infrastructure requirements, the costs that then drive returns. But there's also personal circumstances that come into play as well. So the position of individual landowners in terms of their family positions, taxation, inheritance, various factors come into play which make it very difficult to define a comprehensive benchmark that you can just deploy on all individual sites. And I know we've potentially been unhelpful to you in terms of not defining a specific value to take. And our opinion is that as long as that value
Yeah, the real important terminology here is the competitive return. And to assess what a competitive return is, you have to consider what is actually competing with. And if you kind of set those out, you start with the existing use value. And we know, I think there's probably understanding in the room that that is around the 10,000 per acre benchmark for agricultural land. So that's your starting position. You then need to think about, are there any alternative uses that could command a higher value than that? This was debated a little bit on the delivery options and the approach to the CPO in the fact that there may well be areas of land that on the fringes of existing built development where you may anticipate that there could be development potential there. You would have to do residual appraisals of those bits of land to work out what that residual could be. And it would probably be on the basis of a less intensive infrastructure requirement, so or market-facing values. But that would be relatively small scale when you consider the overall scale of the sites that in question. So whilst there may be some higher value for some fringe areas, that would not be comprehensively applied and adopted across the rest of the area. You also have the issue of what could a CPO deliver in terms of a price. That's another competitive aspect to the consideration. And I think our view on that is that across all of those sources and potential kind of comparisons, they really do not demonstrate that there's much value that would compete with existing use value. There may be some uplift around the fringes, but it certainly wouldn't be applied over much of the land area, which is why we err, and the kind of commentary kind of points you to that way. The competitive return is close to existing use value, but we have to recognise for a willing landowner, you would have to incentivise them to some margin above that to make that appropriate. So we're not saying that the existing use value is that competitive return. We acknowledge you would have to incentivise landowners to do that. We believe it's a small multiple, probably, of existing use value would probably be where we would see that being a most appropriate value to be, and not necessarily at a point of just taking across a kind of fixed level like 100,000 an acre, because that has been used elsewhere.
Right, small multiple. So are we saying fingers of one hand times existing use value?
In a crude sense, probably yes, would be where my professional opinion would be on that matter. And we have to, concluded that issue around the competitive kind of values that you could accrue would be obviously doing the residual land value appraisal of the redevelopment of the land itself.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
drives actually the value that it should be. It would seem perverse to adopt a higher expectation land when you do the appraisal, it comes up with a lower figure. It just does not seem logical for a higher benchmark to exist when the residual drives a lower real figure.
Well, yes, but I mean that goes on to the next question I was going to ask you, really, which is, you can take that logic so far, can't you? But if you take the view that policy requirements should drive land price, and there is merit in that view, because they have to be taken into account. You know, landowners can't just run around, you know, asking the moon for their land without taking into account the policy expectations of infrastructure and other costs that go with a development. So you need to take that into account. But if you go to the extreme of saying the residual land value that comes out when you've applied all the policy requirements is the land value, then that doesn't really help you, does it? Because that could be a ridiculously low figure, and in Colchester Braintree Borders non-grant scenario produces negative residual land values, doesn't it? And that's in a policy compliant situation. So you're not going to expect developers to pay you to develop their land. So there's got to be a limit to the point at which policy-driven residual land value calculations determine the land value.
Yes, you are correct there. I mean, obviously, the residual would have to be above those other competitive returns that you could get, so be that existing use value or an acceptable alternative value.
Okay.
It would have to be above that.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, well, I mean, that's fairly elementary, but I just wanted to clear that out of the way, really. Okay. The NEAs have commented on the appraisals from the site promoters, but I don't think, I mean, I may be wrong, but I don't read into what the NEAs have said any specific criticism of those assessments. I don't read the NEAs as saying other site promoters have assessed infrastructure requirements too low, have put contingency too low. You've made comparisons with them, but you haven't, I don't think, said that what they've done is inappropriate. So if the Savills appraisal, for example, delivers a land value of 100,000 an acre, and that's what a landowner can expect from if the development goes ahead on a private sector basis. But if the appraisal that hires have done, with higher infrastructure inputs and higher contingency, delivers a lower land value, is it the NEA's position that either of those two outcomes is equally acceptable?
I think on the specific point on the Savills work, there was the question, I think it was matter six, or maybe it was one of your original clarification questions, was around whether the NEAs agreed with the Create Consulting infrastructure schedule, which I think the simple answer in the response to that was no.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously the work that we have done with the input from ACOM and Leeds is the evidence that we're relying on, and the phasing and the scale of infrastructure which has gone into the highest appraisal work is the work that we would have based our viability work on and would suggest is based on. Mm-hmm. Now, what that might mean in practice is the flexing of the residual land value expectation. So if there's a greater requirement for infrastructure or an earlier phasing of infrastructure, that would flow through the residual appraisal to drive a lower mm-hmm. expectation of land value. And we would suggest that in terms of proper planning and infrastructure provision, the proposals and assumptions that we've taken would be the appropriate ones, which should lead to that natural conclusion that the expectations should be drawn down as well. What I would accept, though, alongside that, is that there may well be different approaches to delivering certain aspects of infrastructure. There may be more effective or efficient ways to do that. There may also be changes in behaviour and technology, and all sorts of things could happen to change that dynamic over time. So it may well be that alternative approach and alternative assumptions are reasonable and practical. They would all have to be explained and justified at the point in time that they're being properly considered.
I'm not picking on Savills here or anything like that, but let's assume that so the NEAs are relying on the highest appraisal as the one that demonstrates the viability of the scheme, and then you're saying there are other appraisals which take a different approach, which also demonstrate viability in its own context. Let's say, for the sake of argument, and this is not this is in no way saying that I'm prejudging this. I have not prejudged this, and I do not, not even in a position to do so yet. So it's purely hypothetical. But let's say I say to myself, well, looking at all these assessments, and I know that NEAs are relying on the highest one, and yes, okay, I think that demonstrates that the schemes are viable. Well, let's take CBB as the example. Demonstrate that that's viable on the basis of highest is appraisal. And I've looked at the Savills appraisal, and I think that for whatever reason, doesn't demonstrate that it's viable. How can I then know that what will go ahead will be a scheme that reflects the highest appraisal rather than the one that reflects the appraisal I've found to be wanting in a hypothetical world?
Can I interject? And I'm not defending the Savills appraisal in that respect, because if anything, I think it's probably the other way around. Putting that aside, I think, unfortunately, you're in the unenviable position of basically hitting the nail on the head with viability assessments, in that a viability assessment is not a valuation of a site. And a viability assessment is very much based on a number of judgments and assumptions that are made by the developer, by the promoter, by the landowner, by the objectors, by the councils, in terms of what they think can be developed on that site. I can guarantee you, if you gave us all a piece of paper around this table, none of us would come up with the same answer as to how much that site is worth in viability terms. And that therein is the problem. And I think what you have to, unfortunately, weigh up is whether the evidence that has been submitted to you, of which there has been countless by various different objectors and various different parties, whether that gives you the comfort that actually we have thought about the viability of the sites. And I would arguably say that, yes, we have, in some detail. But I think that's up to you, Mr. Inspector.
So may I just add on that point, I'd suggest that this is another context where my note on what deliverable means may be relevant. If you're looking at capability of delivery rather than likelihood, certainty, etc., then if there is one way through that you judge to be viable but the other way through are not, capability has been demonstrated. Obviously, I appreciate that. The deadline for comments on my... I'm not suggesting you take my note as gospel, because other people might have something to say about it. But if I'm right, then I suggest that it may be relevant in this context too.
So thank you very much. And I'm grateful to Mr. Banner for his contribution there and his written contribution, with which I agree in very large measure. But I would invite you in that context, in this judgment that you're being invited to make, to have regard to both the meaning of deliverability and also effective, because that is the place in which we find this word in the definition of soundness. So we're in the middle of a Russian doll. With this particular word, we're looking at deliverability in the context of effectiveness, in the context of soundness. And really, when you're coming to this judgment, which you've just been invited to make, what we would say is that you're really looking here at whether or not the plan would be successful in producing the result which it intends. And so I entirely agree with Mr. Banner, we're not looking here for certainty, but we are looking, we would say, for something more than just capable of delivery. And so when you have this range of materials, Savills, Hyas, etc., the exercise is, we agree, one of judgment, but we would also say that it is one where ultimately you have to be of a view that the plan would be successful. And it may be that one of those documents takes you on its own to a particular outcome. Thank you.
And when I'm making that assessment, if I agree with you that that's the right assessment to make, how do I know what result the plan does intend in order to use that as a yardstick against which to measure the proposals and assessments before me? Do I look to the plan's policies, or what do I do?
So you look to what the principal elements of the plan, the strategic elements of the plan are, and there we're founded very much in the context of garden communities and the attributes of those, and whether or not the plan is going to be successful in delivering those.
Let's stay on this point then. Does anybody else want to come in on this point? We'll come to you, Mr. Bedford, but can I hear from one or two others first, and then I'll come back to you. Mr. Cock.
So I only particularly want to talk about the tendering Colchester borders situation, but just a simple point, really, that it was mentioned that £10,000 per acre was a standard price for agricultural. I think it's about 8,000 is my understanding, rather than 10, but it depends if we're just rounding or what, but you know, that's the sort of figure I think it is. And my experience tells me that normally a basket of various minimum land values that are looked at and often assessed. So 10 times agricultural is one that I've come across plenty of times. £100,000 has been used plenty of times. Schema involved in 3,500 garden suburb at Ipswich was £125,000. So those sort of numbers are often thrown around.
Sorry, just to cut in, would you recognise 5 times agricultural land value as part of that basket?
Not if I was trying to negotiate with a landowner. From my perspective, the highest modelling based on grant and 10% contingency is my baseline scenario. That's the one I work to as being the most correct as far as I'm concerned. The HIF funding has been confirmed, and 10% contingency is a sensible rate. And that gives a £210,000 per gross acre, or £390,000 per net developable acre residual price. And so whatever you use as far as the basket of minimum land values, it more than covers that particular situation with plenty of surplus, obviously.
Just to be crystal clear, when you were talking about basket of values, were you talking about... per gross acre prices?
So often in legal agreements we'll have various benchmarks that are put in. There's not just one minimum land value, it's a whole range of issues, and they may be on a basis of a gross or a net acre a value, so or both.
Mr. Robson?
Thank you, sir. Just moving on from the statements in terms of being successful, and to put a development management context to that, if I may, sir. Just as I understand it, I think we all acknowledge that for these garden communities to be sustainable, they need to be built out in full. They're of an unprecedented scale, and as we heard in the NEA's Matter 1 statements, they're transformative projects. In that context, at development management stage, I think, as I understand it, sir, if there are issues in terms of whether these sites will deliver what the plan is intending, i.e. will they be successful, there are two options in that scenario open to the NEAs. The first is to step in and deliver a locally led development corporation. The second is to look at the Section 106. And there, sir, I'm looking at paragraph 205 of the 2012 framework. I know, sir, you'll know it, but that makes clear that where planning obligations are being sought or revised, local authorities should be sufficiently flexible to prevent planned development being stalled. And so I think in the concept of being successful, it isn't simply a numbers game, it is achieving those garden community principles. Thank you.
Mr. Tristram Eve.
Thank you. I do appreciate that NEGC comes at this a slightly different way, but to someone who's buying land at the moment elsewhere for other organisations, including hopefully some land down at Malden, not too far away, shortly, I've seen much higher figures than the ones that have been bandied about, but equally I've seen agreements with much less and none. And we did cite recently land that came to the market, 3,500 acres of it, by the Crown Estate around the north of Luton, for which my client, Luton Council, actually made an offer. It was on the market, openly on the market, because it would have had been, because it was the Crown, for £35 million, and that included also an industrial estate within it, which had a distinct value itself. So there are examples of land being sold with, and the cottage owners' marketing particulars emphasised the development potential. There was, in fact, a report by somebody called Savills that accompanied the marketing particulars, highlighting the development opportunities. And that was, broadly put, £10,000 an acre. So I just want to make the point that I know the thrust of government policy, and we're not there, is especially aimed at farmers, one might almost say, but there are examples out there of greenfield land being offered at substantially less than the figures that have been talked about.
So I was only going to make, in a sense, a general point, which is to be cautious about, if I can call it that, people like me trying to tell you to use language other than the language you can read for yourself in the MPPF as a substitute for the tests which are set out in the MPPF. I wouldn't invite you to substitute Mr. Kimblin's test of would it be successful? I'd invite you to stay with the language that you see set out in the MPPF. And I wouldn't latch on to any one paragraph and say, well, that's it, that's the test. Particularly in the context of plan making, I would invite you to read effectively from paragraphs 150 through to paragraph 182, which is obviously setting out the soundness test, which I'm sure must be ingrained on your consciousness. But you will see that the language throughout there doesn't seek to be necessarily always prescriptive to one particular phrase or a different particular phrase. At times it talks about opportunities, at times it talks about reasonable prospects, at times it talks about realistic, at times it talks about deliverable, so on. All of these are, if I can call it that, simply ways of trying to, as it were, flag up that there are a lot of planning judgments that you need to make. And I say I would be wary about substituting different language outside of the MPPF for what's in the MPPF itself.
Okay, I'll take another round of comments then on this. Ever-widening question, but relevant, I think. I think definitely relevant. So let's carry on. Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you. I think with respect, you've asked absolutely the right question. And indeed, just as you opened this question with it, it was my first point of the day around whether the viability appraisals are even answering the same question. Are, you know, the HIAS assessment, we've discussed its deficiencies, but it's trying to deliver garden community principles. It's not clear the other appraisals are really trying to deliver the plan in itself. So I think your point around what to focus on, but also the potential gulf that leaves between authorities who own no land, with no ability to, most likely no ability to commandeer that land, and landowners stroke developers, appears to be relatively vast. But I think we can turn our attention back to policy and guidance. The HIAS work itself reviews policy and guidance and notes that, of course, this plan should be reviewed based on the policy and guidance at the time it was submitted. The Harman guidance is extremely important in this context. You yourself refer to it in your June 18 letter. I'll just highlight a couple of points. Page 29, it's important that there is evidence that it, i.e. the premium above current rate, reflects a sufficient premium to persuade landowners to sell. It's important that there is evidence, I emphasise. Page 30, it will be necessary to make greater use of benchmarks, taking account of local partner views on market data and information on typical minimum price provisions used within developer site promoter agreements for sites of this nature. This specifically refers to rural sites. So what we have here is a clear emphasis on reviewing evidence, coming up with benchmarks, and assessing viability against those benchmarks. This has not been done in the HIAS analysis. So we've got clear Harman guidance, and it's effectively being ignored for this purpose. Another comparable plan, for example, which I think is of interest, it's MPPF 2012 again. I believe it quotes the Harman guidance. Uttlesford, they've specifically examined evidence for the A120 corridor, which obviously comes up a lot, and concluded, they quote it in hectares, but in acre terms, it's 100k to 127k an acre. So really ties with the 100 to 150k range we hear elsewhere. And just coming full circle, having emphasised those points, this reinforces, even before considering the sensitivities which I've alluded to around key assumptions, particularly those in your letter, this reasserts my point, particularly west of Braintree, but also clearly West Hay, that these sites are unviable, or even taking the numbers as they're delivered in the HIAS report, at the very best, at the margins of viability, which, coming back to Harman, he specifically cautions against assuming that land will come forward at the margins of viability. Thank you.
Could you just repeat that point about the 120 to 127k per acre? I missed where, yes, that was from and what that related to.
Sorry, I should have been clearer on that. The Troy planning report for Uttlesford, the viability report for Uttlesford specifically has reviewed values for the A120 corridor. In fact, they look at different site typicities, different sizes of sites. So this is garden communities on the A120 corridor. They assess that a suitable benchmark is 100 to 127k. And in fact, the conclusion was then that at least one of the sites in the Uttlesford examination was marginally viable, being somewhat above that range.
Thank you.
I'm afraid I don't have a page reference, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you. Mr. Sonnox.
Yes, I'd like to endorse the idea that trying to do an appraisal without any benchmark to see whether it's viable or not viable has no logic. So we do need a benchmark land value. And the question is, how much above existing use value do you have to go to incentivize owners to bring it to the market? I think there's three different ways of looking at it, and they all come to a surprisingly high answer. First way of looking at it is to think from the, why is there not an infinite supply of land at 100,000 an acre? Well, the answer is the gauntlet, literally, to run the gauntlet for a landowner, to run the gauntlet of the planning system, you have to have a big incentive to do it. And no one has mentioned in here the huge costs of promotion. So you have to look at the land cost, and sometimes more than that, you've got to look at the cost of promoting it, which can run into seven figures. Second way is to look at alternative uses, and Mr. Smith suggested that if his plan showed that there wasn't much residual, then there wasn't an alternative use. It wasn't very attractive. If the policy burden was such that the value was low, then it could be proved that that is a low value, which seems a bit circular. Our point here is that this is an economically inefficient plan, and that landowners have the option of doing a smaller development, which will produce a much higher residual. And I quote again back to the Troy Three Dragons input on benchmark land values, where they're giving very high levels for small sites and rather low levels for big sites, and then they go completely vague on garden communities because they don't want to get caught in a tussle. Okay. So my point is that the alternative use, if you think of the alternative use as a small development, and there's many cases within the blobs that are the garden communities where there is the prospect of small developments, then that's where that's what landowners are going to look at, and that's what will have to be paid. You're buying at efficient market prices payable for an efficient project to create an economically inefficient one. And the last point is to do with expectations. And, the argument that policy burden can produce can reduce expectations is sort of a slightly Canute-like argument in that you've really got to have the harsher policy burden on for many years and on a very consistent basis to push down landowner expectations to where you want them to go. Landowners think in generational terms, in much longer terms than five-year plan periods. So you're going to have to, if you're going to get these, use policy to push down the market value of development land, you're going to have to do it for a long time. I would suggest that if this plan gets caught in that period of expectation adjustment, it just won't happen because no one will be able to reach terms.
Can anyone else who wants to contribute on this question please indicate now? I have got a few, I know that, but I'm just making sure everybody who wants to come in is showing that they want to come in. Okay, Mr. Cock.
I just wanted to add a bit more about minimum land value, and as far as scale obviously has an issue here, and as I talked about what I thought a basket of minimum land values were, but hypothetically if you took £10,000 an acre and, five times for one hand, £50,000 an acre. But if that landowner's got 1,000 acres, £50 million offered to him, and he's then comparing it to his asset, which Mr. Salak says is only giving him a 1% or 1.5% return, maybe he'll think that is a competitive return to be able to take that in the future. So although I don't think property market negotiations allow you to go as low as the figures are suggested, but that's not to say that that doesn't manifest itself in the future as being a commercial return or a good enough return to interest the landowner.
Ms. Gregory.
Thank you very much. Two points. The first one being, I'm glad that Mr. Sonnock's raised the point of promotion costs, because it is something that does generally get forgotten about. We have included it in our viability assessment. It is a large, substantial sum. And I think the very fact that we have included it and the fact that we are here today putting in a lot of time and effort shows that we do consider what we've put forward as deliverable, because otherwise, why would we be doing it? The second point, and this is a slightly more tricky one, and I sort of raised it a little bit yesterday, which is the role of the RICS guidance note versus the Harman guidance.
And going back to the guidance note of 2012, which, as I said, as RICS practitioners, we have to adhere to, it states at paragraph 4.5.5, which is page 25, those undertaking viability appraisals in accordance with this guidance are free to make all reasonable and necessary assumptions and forecasts in formulating a judgment as to the viability of a proposed development or in connection with supporting the formulation of development plan documents in local development frameworks. This goes back to my previous point of viability assessments are not valuations. They are based on a number of judgments. Those judgments are very much tied to the practitioners that are doing the viability assessments, and I think that's something that you're going to have to take into account when you're making your judgment.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thanks. Four point. Yes, I've got it here. Thank you. Mr. Briley.
Thank you, sir. I've almost forgotten the page, the paragraph numbers now, and get so used to saying paragraph 57. But if we go back, really we're talking about paragraph 173 of the MPPF 2012. And the question that is being asked is, does the scale of obligations and policy burdens threaten the viability of deliverability? And you've heard, irrespective of what number you've heard in terms of your benchmark, everyone's saying no. So we're saying basically that the scale and obligations and burdens put on the proposed scheme is not threatening the viability. So I just wanted to bring it back to that point.
Thank you. Thanks. Mr. Oh, right. Anybody else before I come back to the authorities then? Okay, Mr. Ashworth.
A very short point, sir. Mr. Sunnox makes reference to landowner expectations. Landowner expectations can be changed. They can be changed to some extent quite dramatically by the consequences of CPO actions, which are designed to make sure that there's some liquidity in the land market. The MPPF encourages the use of CPO powers. That will start to change attitudes, and the evidence from the old new towns is that once CPOs started to be used, the landowners tended to recognise the inevitability of that and adjusted their expectations accordingly.
Before I go back to inflation, are there any other matters not already discussed that anybody wishes to raise? No. So, I mean, on inflation, as I say, we debated at great length yesterday, and it was useful because I learnt. I got answers to some of the questions to, well, I think to probably to all the questions I had on this, actually. I don't think there's anything more I want to ask about the approach to inflation. I mean, you see, my actual question was whether the NEA's response demonstrates that the inflation scenarios are a valid basis on which to assess the viability of the garden communities, and I heard various views as to whether that was the answer to that question is yes or no, which I will obviously need to evaluate and come to my own view. But really, unless anyone's got anything vitally new they want to add to yesterday's discussion, I don't propose to ask any further questions about it myself. Mr. O'Connell?
With sincerest apologies. I noted yesterday, really a factual point, that there was a significant technical error in the HIAS work, which was using a real finance rate where they should be using a nominal one, so the real finance rate plus inflation in the inflation scenarios. I obviously alluded to the fact this was very significant, but I thought it would be useful to demonstrate exactly how significant that is quantitatively. So, for example, for West Hay, so grant scenario 40% contingency. So the inflation modelling produces a land value, an inflated land value of 500k an acre. So that's using a 6% finance rate, which is the same as in the non-inflation modelling. So if we increase that to 8%, so assuming 6% plus 2% inflation, that 500,000 an acre reduces to £60,000 an acre. I think this really, this is a simple quantitative representation of my point that I emphasised yesterday, inflation is not alchemy. You don't suddenly start doing inflation viability analysis and suddenly everything looks okay. The inflation analysis in the Hyas report is technically incorrect. It's hugely overstated viability. It cannot be relied upon. It cannot be relied upon for various reasons, including the fact that you're comparing an inflated land value to a non-inflated benchmark value. But, you know, 500k an acre to 60k an acre, would, you know, it's absurd. Thank you.
Would you like to comment, Mr. Smith?
Yes, I think I take from that from Mr. O'Connell that he is indicating that the finance rate should be 6 plus 2%, so the 8%. Yes, just to confirm that's the...
Well, if one is using, as they have, a 6% finance rate in the real analysis, which they have, and apparently everyone else has as well, then clearly in a nominal analysis in inflation world, then you have to add inflation to that real finance rate. That is a matter of fact.
Okay, so it's the differential between the finance rate that's used in the inflation scenario as opposed to the other scenarios?
It's converting a real finance rate to a nominal finance, sorry. It's, to clarify, it's converting a real finance rate to a nominal finance rate based on the simple formula of adding inflation to a real finance rate.
At an assumed inflation rate of 2%.
Sorry, based on assumed inflation rate of 2%. We could use a higher inflation rate, but of course that would reduce the land value further.
I think our general position would be that we consider that we've applied a reasonable and appropriate finance rate across all scenarios. I think we did discuss this a little bit yesterday, but we have compared... live finance deals that are done with the types of players that are delivering this kind of development over these kind of timescales, and these are finance deals that do go into the future, so you could assume therefore that they incorporate a future outlook on inflation. And it, again, we've referred a few times today to Urban and Civic as one of the main players out there who are delivering large strategic sites, and I referenced yesterday, I think, that their annual report from 2019 does list a range of finance arrangements that they have in place for their long-term projects. And they in their accounts, they list seven finance deals they've got from different dates, and we could make this material available, but just to quickly run through, they're 3.29%, 3.27%, 3.59% in that ilk. So there are rates that are agreed in the market that span many years into the future, which would therefore pick up a degree of your point around inflation being incorporated. And there's also reference to loans that they receive from Homes England, which are quoted at 2.2 to 4% above the EC reference rate, which is, again is at 3 to 4.75%. So the kind of finance rates we've got in the model at 6% is credible in terms of relating. It's higher than real rates are actually being agreed in the market and rates that go into the future. So we do not feel that the finance rate needs to be extended any further beyond what it is already in the modelling.
I think, Mr. O'Connell, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was making a technical point. I think his point is that if you do a today price analysis, then you use a real interest rate with no inflation adjustment. And if you do an inflation-based analysis, then you have to add inflation to your real interest rate.
That is correct.
As a logical consequence of including inflation in every other part of the analysis, you have to include it in the interest rate as well.
Correct.
Yes, I understand that point, that you may expect a differential. I think what I'm trying to say is that the overall finance rate that we've covered, we believe, is comfortable to cover that higher rate within it. So yes, we are confident that the value that we've chosen there is appropriate under all the scenarios.
Ah, right. So are you saying then you accept the logic, but because you've got examples of 3.5%, 6% covers 3.5 plus 2? Is that the point you're making?
Yes, in a simplistic way you could deduce that.
Well, then I can't compare... If that's the case, then I can't compare the inflation scenario and the non-inflation scenario, can I? Because the real interest rate being used is different then. Because the real interest rate is 4% then in the inflation scenario, isn't it?
Yes, I think strictly that logic seems to follow. I think what I'm trying to say is that the 6% we believe covers all eventuality. If that were higher than the reality in the non-inflation world, then that is that's extra prudence, I guess, in terms of how that finance charge has been assessed in the non-inflation scenarios.
Okay. Mr. Briley.
Do you mind if I just comment for clarity, sir, briefly, before we move on?
No, I'd like to hear from Mr. Briley. I will give you a chance to come back.
Of course. Thank you.
Just a point. We, as a firm, when we look at growth modelling, we use the IRR approach, which obviously excludes interest in its assessment. So it's a good way of circumnavigating the issue that's being discussed here.
Thank you. Mr. Fell.
It's along the same point. I think the fear of trying not to muddy the water, I fear that the two models that have been discussed here are not looking at the same thing. So the highest model looks at residual land appraisal approach. The approach taken when we're looking at inflation and adding that to an interest rate would be in an internal rate of return model. Slightly different models. So I can direct you to there's current RICS guidance on the valuation of development land, which I'll find the reference to you for you in a moment and come back to you, which has a whole section on inflation and internal rate of returns. So an accepted point for Mr. O'Connell, if we're looking at an internal rate of return model to look at an IRR, if you include inflation in your uplift, you should add that margin to the rate that is in your interest rate. But an IRR does a slightly different thing to a residual appraisal. And I would say that in the residual appraisal, it wouldn't be my experience or practice to add 2% when looking at a residual land value. They are slightly different things. You've got internal rates, returns, net present values, and residual land values. Unfortunately, they are slightly different, and the way that you approach them are slightly different. My point is that I accept Mr. O'Connell's position on adding the extra 2%, but I think that's in a different model where you would look at doing that.
And you'd say that whether the RLV model is done at current values or at inflation-adjusted values.
So the RICS guidance on IRR when you're including inflation is that when you look at an IRR model that is trying to track inflation, you would add, if the inflation rate was 2%, you would add the 2% to your interest rate as a risk adjustment, but that is to work back to do an IRR rather than a residual approach. I'm just saying that the two...
Yeah, but if you're doing it residual, I mean, highest have done two... They've done the residual in two different ways, about three, but two for the purposes of this. One is at current values, 2019 values, and the other one is including an inflation element.
But they're still doing it within a residual land value model.
Indeed.
which isn't the same as an IRR cash flow.
I know that. I know, so it's not the same. And you would say whichever it is, if it's a residual land value, whether or not it includes inflation, you don't adjust the interest rate for inflation.
So in my experience, when I'm looking at schemes that have some form of cost increase in the residual land value, I don't add an extra margin to my interest rate in that period.
Okay, and what's the logic of that, of not doing that?
Well, so if you're looking at residual land value that has a cash flow, so money is being cash flowed over a period of time, you're looking at what is the, effectively, if you had a cash flow that shows you the net present value, which will be the inflows or those discounted back, that would be at your interest rate. It's not the same as an internal rate of return, which is a comparative method. Sorry.
Doing residual land valuation.
Yeah, so a residual land valuation is telling me the value of land today.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Over a period of a cash flow.
Yes.
And you're taking all the net, and you get cash flows to get to an end period, and you can do a net present value back.
Yes.
When we look at increases in value through inflation in a residual, my experience is that is not the right place to add 2%. That discounting method would be when we're looking at an internal rate of return, which is where the RSS guidance, which in a moment it's not on my screen, I'll give you the reference to that and take you to where it is. That's where it recommends, if you're going to look at that gross set of assumptions, that would be in an IRR model rather than a residual model.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. I'm not sure you've exactly explained what the logic of that is, but I hear what you're saying about that's the way it's done.
I'll be able, if I direct you to where the paper is and the reference,
okay,
that
might
help.
Okay, yeah, that'd be helpful. Yeah, indeed so, yeah, okay. As part of what you said there, sorry, Mr. Fowler, I don't want to interrupt your searching, but as part of what you said there, assuming you're searching and not... yeah, of course you are. as part of what you said there, you said that in producing a residual land value, you'd take all the cash flows over the period, and then you'd do an NPV back to present-day values.
I'm just saying that there are three. So a residual valuation, a residual land value is slightly different to a net present value. So a residual value...
different. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So they're just slightly different.
Yeah. Right. Not the same thing. Right. Okay. Mr. Sonnox.
Yes, I'm very pleased to hear that in the RICS guidelines, they say that your IRR hurdle should have inflation added in a nominal cash flow, because that has to be correct. I'm slightly alarmed to hear that the profession is going around valuing inflation models without adjusting from real to nominal in their interest rate. And it may be that on short-term developments, that doesn't make much difference. But the really important thing is to remember that we're 50 to 80 years on these things. So these are really, really important things to get right. If the profession is taking a shortcut and looking on a short-term basis inflation, you could justify that in economic theory. But over 80 years, you just can't justify that. And I just wanted to come back on the urban and civic borrowing rate, because I think that's really, really deeply misleading. You've got to remember that urban and civic is a developer which is 75% financed by equity and only about 25% financed by debt. And to look at just their debt rate is utterly, utterly misleading. You would always look at, or I would always look at a weighted average cost of capital. I'd be putting in their cost of equity at 12 to 15%, maybe more, as they have quite a high-risk business model. And then I take the weighted average 75% of 15% plus 25% of 3.5%, give you their weighted average cost of capital, and I think that would be the theoretically correct way of looking at it. It's quite wrong to look at their marginal or their just their borrowing cost in isolation.
Mr. O'Connell.
2 points. One, slightly echoing Mr. Sunnock's, I would direct you back to my matter five comments on this topic around finance rate. I set out in some detail around this point around, you know, urban and civic borrowing at lower rates because of their capital structure. Here we've been looking, as we've repeatedly alluded to 100% debt financed project. You have or will have submitted the paper from Mr. Charlesworth, which I referred to last week, but I obviously discussed that at length, so I would draw your attention to that. It's very significant. Topic of real versus nominal finance rate, this simply couldn't be clearer. I think what I would direct you even to Google to evidence the simplicity of this,
no, I don't think that's
of this point.
But I'm not sure that's
in particular,
something I can do, but go on.
In particular, let me give just an obvious example as to why it's correct. So we're taking increased revenues through inflation, ultimately increased cash flows. But we're only charging interest in a place where we use the same finance rate. We're only charging interest using our real finance rate. So that's fine. We simply have more cash flow to pay that interest and to pay off that debt. It's patently absurd. You can't have an increased cash flow through inflation and not have an increased interest burden. This is why one needs to make the adjustment. You either operate within a real modelling world or you operate within a nominal modelling world. It's possible. I should be crystal clear. There's no confusion in my mind, of course, around IRR versus residual land value. The HIAS appraisal quotes residual land. It quotes IRRs separately, but its main output is residual land values for its real model and residual land values for its nominal model. Those are the two things it's quoting. So my clear assertion is that in relation to the residual land values in the inflation model, of course we need to use an inflated finance rate. It's possible that the RICS guidance refers to an IRR hurdle in an inflation world needing to reflect inflation. Of course it does. An IRR is just a cost of capital. An IRR hurdle is simply a reflection of cost of capital. Of course, you know, a cost of capital is effectively a finance rate. Of course it would have to be increased by inflation. So no inconsistency there at all. This is all the same model. Residual land value and IRR here, with respect to the gentleman down the table, he's talking as though they're produced by different models. They're produced by the same model. We have a model with no inflation in, and we have a model with inflation in. One has to have a real finance rate, one has to have a nominal finance rate. It's very simple.
Mr. Fell, did you manage to find the reference for me?
It's the RSES Professional Standards and Guidance Valuation of Development Property.
Hold on.
So it's the RSS Valuation of Development Property. First edition, October 2019. And it's Appendix B that will give you the section that I was referring to.
This is a document I think you referred to yesterday, didn't you? Or said you weren't going to. I can't remember. It came up in some context, I think, Ms. Gregory.
No, this is actually a separate document. But my point is, this is making me very, very nervous. Because as an RICS registered valuer, the guidance note explicitly states that viabilities are not valuations. I think we have to be very careful that we don't blur the two. And again, I did sort of hint yesterday that we are at this weird position where RICS is sort of out of sync with planning world. And the planning and the RICS professional statement, financial viability and planning, which confusingly was also released in 2019, states that viability assessments should be carried out by suitably qualified professionals. And I think we've got to be very careful here that we actually consider what is a suitably qualified professional. I'll leave that up to you and your judgment. But again, it does sort of supersede the planning world in which this examination is taking place under.
Sorry, which is it that has to be carried out by suitably qualified professionals?
So viability assessments and also valuations. So to be a registered valuer doesn't mean that you... to do viability assessments, you don't have to be a registered valuer. But to be a registered valuer, you have to be on effectively a list of people that carry out development valuations on a regular basis or other valuations. I just do development. Oh, yeah, apparently it does also say that in the new PPG, but obviously we're not meant to talk about the new PPG in this forum.
Right. Yes, indeed. Is there anything I need to take from that? So this is in... viability assessment must be done by suitably qualified professionals, says the RICS, in which publication?
So it says this is the professional statement. So professional statements carry more weight than guidance notes. Professional statements mean that as RICS professionals, we have to adhere to it.
Yeah.
Whereas guidance notes are, they are guidance.
Yeah, sure.
It's strongly recommended that you adhere to it.
So professional statement dated?
2019.
Title?
I believe it's financial viability and planning.
But not the guidance note of 2012?
No, rather confusing.
Same title, different publication.
Yeah, they don't make things easy for us.
Do you have the paragraph reference? Doesn't matter if you don't.
No, I'm sure I can find it for you.
That is one thing I could, not Google, but I could word search that one. So you're quoting that. I mean, what do you want me to take from that? That some people here are not suitably qualified, or... I mean, I'm not suitably qualified, but I mean...
This is what I mean about opening up a very dangerous can of worms, particularly with viability, which is so important to planning, and particularly local plans examinations. Mm-hmm. I am nowhere near qualified enough to say who is suitably qualified or not at this stage. I'm pretty sure all the QCs are desperate to get involved in defining this.
We've finished early today.
No, I honestly, if I'm being completely honest, I think it's a dangerous can of worms to open, but unfortunately, it's something that does need to be raised because, again, as an RICS professional, we now have to operate under the professional statement. It just so happens that the professional statement has kind of superseded where we are with this local plan examination.
Okay. All right. But, I mean, I've still got to grapple with them. I may or may not be suitably qualified, but I've still got to grapple with them, haven't I? So,
yep, sorry.
I'm not undertaking one. I'm simply looking at what's been presented to me and using that as part of the evidence, which may or may not demonstrate the soundness of the plan. So it's a different relationship. OK, Mr. Briley.
I fear it might be my fault that word is in there, because I advise the RSS to put it in. It's effectively a reference back to the new PPG, which says that you have to have a suitably qualified person to be undertaking this. And it seemed to be reasonable to me that the RSCS were an appropriate body for doing that. So that's where it comes from, and that's why it's appeared most recently in this professional practice statement. I think they mean that someone who is RSCS qualified and has done sufficient amount of this work before, which I'm assuming a number of people around this table could claim.
Thank you, sir. I just wanted to perhaps get back to the crux of the question and step back slightly from some of the detail, which is just obviously to look at how much weight and how valid the basis or valid inflation scenarios as a basis for testing the viability of garden communities are. And we heard yesterday, and we've rehearsed that today as well, that we're looking at PPG 2014. Now, paragraph 8 is obviously quite clear about the approach that should be taken to plan making, and whilst it doesn't preclude utilising inflation within this testing, it does actually guard against it and highlights that we should be looking and primarily focusing on current costs and values when assessing the viability of plan making. Policies should be deliverable, and that there should be some caution expressed in reading into this
The words are to help ensure realism and avoid complicating the assessment with uncertain judgments about the future if inflation is to be utilised and if growth scenarios are to be utilised in this type of modelling. Thank you.
Mr. Tristram Eve.
Thank you. I wasn't going to enter the murky waters of IRR, and I was just simply going to observe that when NEGC has been soft market testing and talking to funders, they've been looking at long-term funding up to 40 years, and the references that Richard Bailey was quoting are all on the basis of long-term funding, which is referencing appropriate gilt rates as the benchmark. So we've certainly been looking at arrangements for finance that would be long-term, not just short-term.
I think before I invite Mr. Bedford to come back for the authorities, I'll take final contributions from the other side. So are you waiting to speak, Mr. Sonnox? Yeah, Mr. Sonnox and Mr. O'Connell.
Just quickly coming back on the long-term finance, I noticed that it's one thing being able to quote a gilt rate out of 40 years, which you can do. It's quite another thing finding someone who will lend you money on a fixed interest for 40 years. And I see that Homes England loans are typically 8 to 12 years. So I think trying to fix your finance that far out, even for the debt part of it, remember that's only 25% of it, you'd be lucky to do it certainly for 80 years. On the equity part of it, of course, the returns are real anyway, so you don't have the same problem. I just want to come back on this business of being suitably qualified, which I feel may be a dig at this side of the table. And I just feel that the planning system should respect the RICS, but they're not the only institute of people that do appraisals. I'm a member of the Chartered Accountants Institute, and they would not regard the RICS, I'm sure, as having a monopoly on the ability to do viability appraisals. And also, it compels me, I'm afraid, to state why I think that Mr. Connell and I are suitably qualified. I'm a chartered accountant. I have an MBA, specialising in finance, and I've been 30 years finance director of a property company looking at these appraisals and making decisions based on them. So I feel I am suitably qualified, and I'm sure Mr. O'Connell will speak for himself, but participating in financial markets, I would regard him as suitably qualified. So I hope you won't allow that to reduce the credibility of what we say.
Not at all, I've seen head shaking across the room in a positive way that there was no implication of devaluing anything that you've said or your qualifications. So no, not at all, and I very much welcome your input as much as anyone else's into the discussion, Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you. I'd just like to turn to this RICS guidance because I'd hate to have to follow up on a simple point afterwards as a point of clarification. The specific relevance of this document beyond any others, I think, is not the point in question, but as the gentleman down the table has referred to it, I think it's best just to read exactly what it says. Appendix B is entitled Treatment of Inputs into the Residual Value Method. Change in values can be specifically incorporated into the cash flow, and it is important to identify whether the cash flow incorporates expected changes. The adoption of either current or projected values, and they use projected as a shorthand version of saying inflation models, as I think you heard yesterday, raises questions of consistent treatment of other inputs such as the costs, plural. It also raises questions of whether real or nominal rates of interest are used in the valuation, i.e. target rates of return, that would apply to the IRR part that we were talking about, and the use of real or nominal finance rates. This is the document that was referred to.
Raises questions.
Well, they're talking about making sure that one applies the right inputs into the residual value method. Thank you.
Do you want to come back, Mr. Fell, since you raised that?
Only to say that in that context, when it's looking at the IRR, that I agree with. So let's just take for a moment the example of sensitivity analysis that you see through the process. So as at a residual appraisal methodology, if we do sensitivity analysis that increases sales values by £10 a foot, £20 a foot, whatever it may be, in a sensitivity analysis to look at the residual land value, we don't change the interest rate on those residual valuation appraisals to look at sensitivity analysis on those increases in values. So I'm just saying that I'm not disagreeing that you would account for inflation. I'm just saying that that's in an IRR model. That's all I'm saying.
But if you sensitise for increasing costs, you're still doing that at present day values, aren't you? Whereas if you take an inflation based approach, that then you're compounding the increase, aren't you, over time?
But the residual value is bringing it back to as at today's value. So what can I pay today for these sets of assumptions as at today? And the IRR, looking at the returns and the hurdle rates, I mean, I think the interpretation when you look at that, that it might be more helpful to look at the section there in the IRR.
I will look at it, and I'll read what it says. But I don't get from what you're saying why in principle you would not apply a nominal interest rate. I just don't get it, because I don't see that sensitizing build costs in a present day value assessment is the same thing as projecting forward over time a differential between revenue inflation and cost inflation. I don't think it's the same thing.
I would urge you, if I may say, to look at this exact paragraph. And indeed, I thank you for drawing our attention to this important guidance. Paragraph B1.1.9. Mm-hmm. It specifically, as I read out, it alludes to incorporating things into cash flows. Interest goes into cash flows. It is talking about calculating cash flows with interest, and it says you need to use. You need to consider whether to use the real cost in a real model or the nominal cost in a nominal model. I should also, just for completeness, because I think it would be ideal if there was no residual confusion on this point. Benjamin Nalentay just referred to residual land value being a present value. It's important to appreciate residual land value is specifically not a net present value. Hmm. There's no idea of discounting value back to today. It's subtracting one set of cash flows from another. There's no present value nature of it. So indeed, we're not talking about discount rates at all in residual value. And as I highlighted, this guidance is referring to treatment of inputs into the residual value method. So I would absolutely urge you to look at this for confirmation of what is an important and very clear point.
Okay, well, I just want to confirm before I do, the paragraph number again.
Sorry. So it's Appendix B, and the reference is B1.1.9.
Thank you.
And I believe I quoted the paragraph in full.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. I'll look it up. Okay, I mean, what I think I heard you say earlier, Mr. Smith, but I'd like you to confirm this if I can, is that you didn't disagree with Mr. O'Connell that the right way to approach a residual scenario of the type you've done for the garden communities on an inflation basis, so the inflation-based assessments. You, as I understand it, you didn't disagree with him. In fact, you agreed with him that you needed to make an inflation adjustment to the finance rate. But what you said was, I think you can confirm, is that 6% was enough to cover the basic real rate plus the interest adjustment so that it was enough to cover a nominal rate in that scenario. That's what I understood you to say. Was that right?
That's correct. That's effectively what I said.
Thank you. Thank you. Right. Mr. Tristram Eve.
Sorry, I just wanted to pick up on one point. I think Mr. Summocks said we in our model are not looking at Homes England lending. We've never said we were, so I'm not going to dispute or debate whether it's 6 to 8 years or EU reference. To be clear, we are looking at a different form of lending or borrowing for the duration, and that's the conversation that I'm not having, but Richard Bailey was alluding to yesterday. And what it's seeking to achieve.
Thank you. And I'll ask Mr. Bedford. This will be the last contribution from the NEAs.
Thank you. Well, so I may bring in Mr. Smith on a point of detail. What I wanted to just reflect on, and if I can introduce my qualifications as somebody with a CSE in mathematics, so I'm quite prepared to be told that I've got things completely wrong. So I'm not looking at it from, as it were, any particular point of expertise. But I was struck by, as it were, the apparent dramatic effect of the adjustment that Mr. O'Connell put to you, which is where obviously this debate started, where he said, well, if you wash through what he said was the appropriate inflation adjustment to the finance charge that Hyas had used, the 6%, in the inflation scenario, it's when you obviously washed it through the calculation, it had the effect of reducing a value per acre of 500,000 down to 60,000. Which obviously seemed to me to be quite a dramatic change. And so what I just wasn't clear about, and I say I'm quite happy to be told that I've misunderstood matters, but if you are inflating costs and revenues in the exercise by 2%, which I think was the inflation rate that was being referred to by Mr. O'Connell, it didn't seem to me that it then followed that you would inflate the interest rate by adding 2% to it, as opposed to inflate the interest charge by 2%, which wouldn't be quite the same thing. And so I wasn't quite clear that it was actually, if you're applying, as it were, a constant inflation assumption to all elements of the calculation, whether it would be right that if you've got a 6% interest charge, it would be appropriate to actually add 2% to that 6%, as opposed to inflating the interest charge by 2%. So that's the point that I just would hope that there could be some clarification around that.
You mean increase the interest charge, so 2% of 6%, do you mean?
That would be a way of doing it.
Fair point. Fair question. Yeah. I mean, I think the two parts of that. The first is the. I suppose the first question is Now I'll let you deal with this. I'll let you deal with it, and then I'll come back with my supplementaries rather than trying to put words into your mouth. So if you answer, and then I'll. If I need to clarify anything, I'll come back.
Sure. So two questions. One was the dramatic result. Mr. Sunnock's provided this number for me. He's replicated the Hyas model, both the non-inflation and inflation cases, with great accuracy. I guess I refer back to my points around the highly leveraged nature of the sites. And, of course, what we have, as we see in the inflation cases, is all of the numbers go like this. So we shouldn't be surprised that if we change the interest rate, there's a correspondingly dramatic move downwards. And I draw your attention, I draw the inspector's attention, to my points on inflation not being alchemy. Second point about increasing, I guess you're talking about, the formula for increasing a real interest rate to a nominal interest rate is just adding inflation to it as an absolute number. So 6 + 2, for example, equals 8. It's not about increasing it by a relative amount. That's just the formula for doing it. So it's obviously good that you've asked the question, but the answer is that you take an absolute inflation figure as a percentage, so 0.06 plus 0.02 or 6% plus 2%, just the same thing, and that gives you 8%.
Okay, so can I follow up with you on that? So why 2%?
Oh, 2% is just a proxy for inflation here. It's sort of the standard Bank of England assumption. It could be a higher number.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a useful number to work with, in fact, sure. Because a higher number would produce a dramatic result, and I didn't want to.
Sure. Yeah.
I didn't want to talk about a number through EUV. Over dramatise things. Well, potentially not.
Yeah. Okay. And I suppose maybe this is for my benefit, but also perhaps because this to some extent goes in line with the question asked by Mr. Bedford. So if you take the Bank of England proxy of 2% to get to your nominal interest rate, do you have to adjust the other inflation assumptions? Because as you recall, the inflation assumptions in HIAS are 4% growth on sales revenue, 4% growth on infrastructure costs, 3.5% growth on build costs. So do you have to adjust those as well? Or is there any inconsistency between...
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think there are sort of two separate but complementary answers to that. One is that, in simplistic terms, yes, you could do that, and you'd be using the same inflation rate throughout the whole analysis. The impact that would have in this context is to drag down the 500k an acre residual land value calculated by the inflation case, most likely. So I guess we'd be changing, so the 60, I guess we'd have 500k an acre would be a lower number to start with if we changed the inflation rate to 2%, and I guess the 60k would be lower as well. So you could increase and have a higher nominal finance rate to reflect, I think, the 3 or 3.5%, but that would drag your adjusted for a higher finance rate residual value down. So I guess my point is I've made a conservative, what I perceive as a conservative adjustment to the finance rate, so as not to overstate or over dramatise this impact.
I just want to ensure that we wouldn't be making a school by error you get the point, don't you? That HIAS have input certain inflation assumptions into their model.
Yeah.
I just want to know whether that means that you then need to choose. I mean, is it legitimate in those circumstances just to say right it's 2%, or do you need to relate the adjustment you make to arrive at a nominal interest rate? Do you need to relate that to the other inflation assumptions embodied in the model?
Yes, no, I do understand the question, and clearly my answer to it wasn't clear enough. So first point to make is probably, in reality, we're talking about sort of construction inflation,
yes.
Whereas I think the rate that one would naturally use to adjust a real to a nominal rate is sort of broader CPI-type inflation.
I see.
So I think it makes sense that they're different numbers.
I see.
But I think one could legitimately use, for example, 3.5%, which I believe is the highest number, 3 or 3.5%. One could use that, in my example, to adjust the real interest rate to be a nominal interest rate. And that would just obviously have the function of bringing down the 60K that I quoted down to a much lower number. So if we did standardise the inflation assumption between HIAS and the interest rate, it would just mean 500K probably went through EUV, I would imagine. So
yeah.
No issue doing that at all. I used a conservative rate so as not to overstate the impact.
Yeah.
But from a technical point of view, I think the inflation used to adjust the real rate to the nominal rate is probably not the same as construction inflation anyway.
Mm.
But
I
don't think there's any need to focus on that. Mm. On that technical point, I think we could say, sure, let's use the same inflation rate as in the highest number, and it would just mean that 500k came down probably through EUV.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Right. Are you going to also try and help me with an answer, Mr. Sonnex?
Yes, I think it's useful to know. I did this modelling. If you put in the same inflation rate for everything and... you add it to your discount rate, you get more or less exactly the same answer as you do in the real model, which is exactly what you would expect. I just think it's useful to know that.
Yeah, of course.
So what some of the
others? Which is what Mr. Bedford was saying, in fact.
Yes,
I think.
And so some of the some of the developer models have just put in an extra 1% or something for house price inflation, left everything else real.
Yes.
It's the differentials that matter. Inflation doesn't per se change anything. If you do it correctly and you do it consistent across the board, you come up with the same answer. Mm. So coming up with 500,000 as the answer against 57,000 in the real model is not what you'd expect, to put it politely.
This is back to the point on alchemy. It should be sort of, you shouldn't be able to create value through using equal inflation assumptions like that, which actually reveals the technical error in itself. Mm.
Mr. Tristram Eve.
I just wanted to observe, because someone is using a lot of models that look a long way out and seeing other people's models look a long way out, that it is usual that people are making different forecasts for what prices might do, including commercial and build costs and construction costs and sometimes average earnings. And, well, we've got long... data on RPI, rather less on CPI. We referenced the fact in our paper that you can go back quite a long way with certain data sets like ONS, less so with land registry. But it is commonplace to be applying different judgments, not necessarily the same judgment, because if you do, as been pointed out, you often end up more or less where you started. And sometimes we've done it stripping out RPI so that you're using real inflation rates, if I can put it like that, but that will just add to confusion of a topic I think that's probably run its course.
Yes, I think we all have that feeling. Mr. Smith, you want to wrap up? On this one.
Yes, I hope to be able to wrap up and not open up anything else. I think I just wanted to bring it round to maybe a bit of perspective and context, and actually some of the points that were just raised in the latter stages of that debate picked up some of the things I was going to say. We've had a lot of focus on the finance rate and potential 2%, and as was just discussed there have been different inflation rates that we've assumed in that inflation model, and the 4% and the 3.5% were just the assumptions that we took to this. There are different assumptions, as was discussed yesterday, from both the L&Q approach and the Avison-Young, and if you look at the bodies like Urban and Civic, they all do apply this differential between value and cost. And if you were to start doing that, the figures would start going in a totally different way. So I think we all know that inflation, no one knows what the future holds for inflation, and we have just made an assumption on that to provide it as a scenario. It is just a scenario in the information you've got there. We do not predicate the viability assessment on that scenario. We merely show it to illustrate what impact inflation could have. And it may be helpful to you in your judgment if I were to draw your attention probably to what we believe to be the most optimum scenarios in the matrix of scenarios and figures you've got, just to draw your mind possibly to where greatest weight lies. On the West of Braintree scheme, obviously there is the reference case analysis that's there between the 10% and the 40% contingencies, which drives the residual values. We would say that the reference case is obviously the greatest weight in terms of which set of scenarios you should be looking at. From my professional opinion, and has been discussed by others, the 10% contingency
contingencies would be where traditionally things are left, but I understand the purpose of this examination needs to test those extra contingencies, and you directed us to do that, so I understand that range that you need to consider. On the tendering Colchester borders...
Bear with me. So you would say greatest weight to west of Braintree, 10K, reference case, 10% contingency. This is your opinion.
Yes.
300 DPA.
Yes, that
You're sitting on 300 DPA, are you?
That was our core evidence, yeah, as you say. Okay. We've done that sensitivity test on the 250 as well. So obviously you'll take that
into
account.
I've got to take a view on build-out rates along with everything else, but I'm hearing your opinion here. Yep.
Yes. Yep. So that was on the west of Braintree. On the tendering Colchester borders, obviously we do have the HIF award that's in place there, so we would put greatest weight on the grant scenarios.
Yeah.
And the same position applies to the contingencies. So professional opinion would be to err on the 10%, but understand the need to test the range up to the 40%.
So grant case, 10%, 300 DPA?
Yep.
Yeah.
And on the Colchester-Braintree borders, again, the grant scenario would be the one that we'd assume to have the greatest weight, and we acknowledge that the HIF decision has not been made, but we've made previous kind of statements and representations that reasonable prospect of securing some form of government grant over time we would consider to be a likely scenario. So we would err on the grant scenario being the most appropriate there, and the same position on contingencies.
So grant 10%, contingency 300 DPA. Okay, thank you very much. That is useful to know. I mean, that's very useful to have that confirmed. But obviously, I will look at all the evidence, not just from yourselves, all your scenarios, but all the evidence presented by others around the table in terms of assessments and analyses of assessments and all the comments made. So thanks ever so much. It's been an education as much as anything else. And a very useful two days. And we are finishing nice and early. And many of us will be back tomorrow morning to discuss sustainability appraisal. Thanks all very much.